Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There are a few people that I have come across who have more intelligence and bring it to bear more effectively than our first guest. His name is Lee Smith. You probably know him through his longer form writings or perhaps his media contributions in places like Tablet Magazine. But whether it's the permanent coup, the enemy's foreign and domestic targeting the American president, or his essays, or his various interviews. He did a fabulous one with Tucker Carlson the other day at Fox Nation, which I really commend to you. He is a go-to guy on matters involving national security policy in particular, and I'm privileged to have him here as a guest once again. Lee Smith, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's great to have you.
Frank, great to be here, and thank you so much for that profoundly kind introduction. It's very generous. It's great to be with you.
And deserved.
Thank you.
Thank you. Listen, I've got a commentary out today about what I think we ought to increasingly be thinking of when the topic of the Biden presidency comes up. It really would be better described, it seems to me, as a wrecking operation. And I wanted to just go through a number of things that I know are on your mind and on mine that are evidence of this. And maybe we could start with what the administration is doing to what used to be our southern border and immigration policy more generally, and why?
Well, I think that the common understanding, I think, is correct, is that the idea this is not about justice, or this is not about trying to help out asylum seekers. They're not seeking asylum. This is political, they're economic migrants. The reason that the Biden administration is opening the borders, again, I believe the common assessment is right. They're trying to change the balance of the United States, the political balance of the United States.
Yeah, the voting population of the country, yeah. Especially when you see the New York Times, you know, opining that why restrict voting to citizens? I mean, for heaven's sakes, this is a pretty straightforward formula for changing who votes.
Yes, it's offensive and racist to limit voting to citizens. Look, what it's really about, though, is we've entered a stage where the ruling establishment, and I'm not just talking, unfortunately, about Democrats and the Biden administration, and there are many Republicans as well. The corporate establishment as well, who is also on board, with destroying the idea of citizenship that binds this country together. The idea of that there is a country. There are lots of people who have a stake in this, so they may not intentionally be trying to destroy the idea of citizenship. Though, of course, it's profoundly corrosive. And what we're seeing, therefore, in the ruling establishment, again, not just the Biden administration, in the ruling establishment is we're seeing a decaying regime. The entire regime, not just the Biden administration, is no longer fit to rule this country. If they're not able to control the borders, if they're not able to manage the country, and therefore the idea of citizenship, then they're no longer fit to rule. And we see that happen in all sorts of different, not just policies, but in all sorts of different actions that the very people who are running the government right now have participated in. So we've entered a very an interesting phase in American history. It's not a great one. We're not seeing a ruling establishment coming, approaching its strength. We're seeing a very serious decline, and all the signs are unmistakable from also the different signs of of political corruption, of moral corruption. The son of the president is a very tragic figure. Nonetheless, he's corrupt. And the idea he's being paid by the establishment in all sorts of different ways. If you look at the number of people in the
and the Chinese establishment, for that matter, as well.
Yes, right. If you look at all the different people in the administration and what they were involved with targeting the previous president, Donald Trump, whether it was between Russiagate or the bogus impeachment processes, or if we're looking at January 6th, the idea of trying to label half the country white supremacists. So again, we're seeing that the problem is no longer politics at this point. The problem is moral, and the ruling establishment has lost the ability to govern the country. The problem is moral corruption, not political.
Yeah, there's so many ways to go from what you've just said. That's a very rich table. Maybe I could pick up on a point that you made with Tucker the other day, and that sort of flows from what you were saying about the corruption of not just the government, but the business elites of our country, Lee Smith. And you know, you coined the phrase that they've been selling America off for parts to China. And in the process, helping transform an enemy that you don't want to inspire to believe that it can have its way with you. And yet, I think the sum and substance of what you've just described is clearly an inducement, if any were needed, and it probably isn't, to a guy like Xi Jinping to believe that, you know, the inevitable rise of China and the inevitable decline of the United States is conducing to potential opportunities for aggression of one kind or another.
Right. China is a very large country of 1.4 billion people. It's a very powerful country. It's a very serious and prestigious country. Nonetheless, if you look at China plainly outside of the assessments of, again, our ruling establishment, you realize that China is not the inevitable power it's made itself out to be. China would not be where it is. And this is why I say our major strategic threat is not China, but it is our corporate and political, academic, cultural, and media establishment that has empowered China at the expense of the United States. As we know, look, communism is, people try to make communism a very complicated thing, talking about Marx. Everyone you meet who is going to talk about communism will not have read Marx's masterwork, Capital, right? It's not that complicated a thing. What happens is you have an oligarchy, and what the oligarchy does is it drains the wealth of the middle class. That's what it does, and establishes two classes, whether we want to call it the nomenclatura or the oligarchy. That's what you have on top. At the bottom are peasants. What China did was, it was fascinating. The middle class wealth that it drained was not Chinese. It was American middle class wealth. And it was our people, our ruling establishment, who made that possible, who sold off American industry, American strength, American enterprise,
and not least just our capital. The loss of $400 billion. Some are saying, it may be a trillion before they're through with us. But it's money that is out the door, and you're right. It's come from, you know, the pension funds of ordinary people, by and large. Deplorables, for want of another term.
That's right. The large institutional investors, one of the things they've done, which is absolutely shocking, even during the midst of the pandemic, say what you will about the pandemic, whether it's the plague that apparently Anthony Fauci says it is, or something else. The fact is that we should not be encouraging Chinese biotech firms during the middle of a pandemic that the Chinese are clearly responsible for. Nonetheless, institutional investment funds are pouring American money into Chinese biotech. It's astonishing. So that's who they are.
That's on top of
their corruption.
Yeah, speaking of Tony Fauci, that's on top of him putting taxpayer money into biotech operations, specifically biowarfare operations of the Chinese Communist Party.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So it tells you, it staggering. Gives you an indication of who these of, of who our ruling class is.
Yeah, yeah. Let me come back to white supremacism, Lee. We're told insistently that this is the greatest threat to the homeland security, and it must be rooted out, among other places, from the United States military. Again, my commentary today is about, you know, the wrecking operation that's aimed at the United States military in the kind of environment you've just described. And this is only part of it, of course. We've got Russia, which is feeling its oats as well. We've got the Iranians. We've got a new communist regime in power in Peru, and heavens knows what will flow from that. These are the sorts of turbulent times that remind me of Don Rumsfeld's famous or infamous line about, you know, you go to war with the military you have, or army. What we're looking at is potentially a breaking of the United States military as a further part of this wrecking operation, whether it's the purging of so-called extremists and white supremacists and Trump voters, or the racist training that they're subjecting the military to, or now the insistence that everybody has to be vaccinated. I have the feeling a lot of military personnel are going to say, I'm out of here, rather than do that. Thoughts?
I mean, if some of the, here's an important demographic that's generally hid in conversations about the military. The fact is that white men still constitute the core of the American military. I mean, those are the people who sign up to fight and kill enemy combatants. Combat
and die
are made
if necessary.
Right. I think the number is something like there are like 9 support units for every 1 combat unit. Those combat units are the vast majority are white men. So the idea that you're going after the white men in the military, rooting out white supremacy, I mean, again, I don't believe it's to make the military woke. I believe it's to rid the military of white men and to discourage white boys from joining. So,
let's talk about what's the purpose of doing that. It's like repopulating the police. It's not being done just because you don't like white men. It's to an end, is it not? What would that be?
I think there are a couple of different purposes. I mean, I think the number one effect is that it makes the American military less able to wage combat operations. If you're getting rid of your combat units, you're less able to wage combat operations, right? That's a fairly serious thing.
Diminished, and that's the thing that's so ominous in this environment, as I said, Lee. Hey, quickly, when I know we're going to run out of time with you before we run out of things to talk about, let me just come back to something that it flows from all of this, the white supremacism and, you know, turning us against each other. You've written powerfully the other day at Tablet about America's new political prisoners. Would you just comment on what's up with what is being done to these folks who have been, implicated, for want of a better term, in the January 6th events?
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely terrible. I mean, these people, there are people who have been held for nonviolent offenses now for 6 months.
Without being charged, right?
Yeah, right. I'm not sure about that. I mean, the trials have been, the DOJ, Department of Justice seeks to delay all the trials so they can amass evidence. They want to push trials back to early 2022. I mean, this is absolutely insane, right? Nonviolent offenses, some of them for misdemeanors like trespassing. They've been held for 6 months. They're being labeled as white supremacists. They're being labeled as insurrectionists, not only by the Department of Justice, by the press, right? There've been very severe lockdowns. So this comes back also what I'm saying about the moral corruption of the regime, because you'll notice what's happening here. It's the Biden Department of Justice, but where is the Republican Party on this? There's a handful of them. You see certain senators then make a case about Cuban freedom fighters, Cuban pro-democracy activists who are being, captured by the regime. You know, God bless Cuban democracy activists. That's fantastic. We root for them. Nonetheless, we have political prisoners here in the United States that are being held by the Biden administration's Department of Justice. Judges are signing off on these detention orders. It's obscene. And where are Republicans on this?
The controlled opposition is, I'm afraid, where they are. And it's not helpful to a cause that is as desperate as ours is at the moment. Lee Smith, I know we have to let you go. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. Fascinating. Very important conversation. We'll do it with you in the near future. Thank you. Next up, Robert Joseph, former Undersecretary of State, talks about the Chinese nuclear breakout and more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and we are joined by one of my favorite people. His name is Robert Joseph. He formerly served, among many, many other things, as the Undersecretary of State for, well, arms control, among other international policy challenges, a position that has been held by a number of luminaries, including John Bolton. He has served in the Defense Department. He has served at the National Security Council. He is these days a senior fellow at the National Institute for Public Policy, terrific organization in Washington, D.C. And he has been teaching at Southwest Missouri University for some time in its highly acclaimed defense studies program. He is, among other things, one of the country's preeminent authorities, I believe, on arms control and its serious deficiencies. And I want to talk with him about that in the context of a problem that has seemingly just burst forth, surprising a lot of people. I call it the Chinese nuclear breakout. I must say, I've been anticipating it for quite some time, but it has taken a number of our colleagues, and especially in the arms control community, I think a bit by surprise that suddenly there have turned up 250 silos that apparently are meant for intercontinental ballistic missiles, capable of each of them delivering something like 10 nuclear warheads against targets, well, here in the United States. His name is Robert Joseph. I am very pleased to have him back for an extended conversation about the challenge that these developments, among others, out of China represent. And Bob, it's good to have you back on Secure Freedom Radio. Thanks so much for joining us.
Frank, thank you. It's great to be back with you. Appreciate the invitation.
Always a pleasure. Let me ask you, Bob, it has been something of a canonical assertion of the arms controllers that the Chinese Communist Party has 200, maybe 300 nuclear weapons, and it will always be that way, no matter what. The development of these silos speaks otherwise. It's not the only evidence that the Chinese actually have long since left that level of forces in the rearview mirror. But talk a bit about the Chinese nuclear capability, what it is at the moment, as best we can tell, and what you think is in the offing now.
Well, Frank, first of all, I think the narrative about China having 200 to 300 nuclear weapons goes back for decades. And it's not simply confined, unfortunately, to the arms control community. It has also been adopted by not many in the intelligence community. And we've seen this refrain over and over that China has nothing but a minimum deterrent that would only be used in retaliation if the United States were to use nuclear weapons against it. Well, I tell you, the recent revelation about new ICBM fields, you mentioned up to 250 silos, about all of the new types of nuclear weapons that they're developing and deploying, including new submarine launch capabilities, new bomber capabilities, hypersonics with nuclear tips, nuclear tip cruise missiles. It's the whole spectrum of nuclear capabilities that are being developed. And this runs counter to that narrative, and it runs counter to the narrative of no first use, which has also been a canonical element of the arms control community's description of China. Well, just last week, the Chinese threatened first use against Japan if Japan were to intervene, if China were to attack Taiwan.
It was repeated nuclear use, no less. It was not just a single strike, but you're absolutely right. It was a first strike.
It's a first strike. And, you know, if you look back, you can see that the Chinese have often made statements that are contrary to their propaganda point about no first use, a propaganda point that is absolutely accepted by the arms control community and, again, by the intelligence community. I can't tell you how many briefings I've had in which the Chinese nuclear force is described as a minimal deterrent that will not be
counter city at that, as I understand it. Right?
Well, yes, absolutely counter city. Absolutely. But now they're clearly building a counter-force capability.
And Bob, one other data point here that I just have to insert, because, again, you'd think that this would have really roused, at the minimum, the intelligence community to a different attitude. But a former colleague of ours in the Pentagon, Phil Carber, at Georgetown University several years ago now, got his students, graduate and undergraduate students, together for a project, and they tumbled upon the fact that it had been missed by our intelligence agencies, as I understand it, that there were 3,000 miles of hardened underground tunnels that the Chinese Communist Party had built, evidently for the purpose of concealing and moving about, among other things, probably some substantial number of intercontinental range ballistic missiles. Now, again, this belies the idea that they only had 200 to 300 warheads. You wouldn't go to that trouble and expense, for heaven's sakes, to hide just that small number of weapons, would you? And if that's all true, Bob, wasn't that a canary in the mine shaft years ago about what the Chinese were actually up to?
Well, I think it was one of many canaries that go back decades. We've seen indicators that are inconsistent with this notion that there are 200 to 300 and it's a minimal deterrent. But today, I think there is a consensus, if you look at what's being produced by the arms control community, that China is moving forward very aggressively. Admiral Richard, the STRATCOM commander, has described it as breathtaking, saying that the stockpile will be double or triple or quadruple. General Hyten has made the comment that China is building nuclear weapons faster than any nation on the planet. There is this realization now that China is moving very quickly, and I would say as part of a broader strategy, because it's not just nuclear force. They now have more ships in their navy than we do. Their air force is expanding. Their missile force continues to expand. And remember, today China has, I'm told, 95% of the world's INF missiles. Okay,
these intermediate range missiles, which we were barred from having under the INF treaty that you and I worked on many decades ago. So, Bob, let me add just one other piece of this, which, to your point, is so important. I think we're looking at really a comprehensive effort by the Chinese Communist Party to have dominant power militarily. And one other element of it is what they're doing to have dominant positions in space as well. That's not often discussed in the context of strategic nuclear capabilities, but it certainly has relevance, does it not?
It does, as does cyber and so many other aspects of the Chinese overall strategy to replace the United States, to replace us as the preeminent power in the Asia Pacific area.
And that makes it sound benign. It's really a hostile takeover of that status, is it not? And the idea being to dominate, if not to actually destroy us in the process.
And I think they're well on their way.
Or at least having the capability to do it. That's the troubling thing. Bob, there's also an interesting development. I saw just the other day that the Chinese have for the first time admitted Russian personnel onto Chinese soil for the purposes of conducting joint strategic nuclear exercises in which they simulate attacks against our country. joint attacks. This isn't the first time that they've had joint exercises, but it apparently is the first time that Russians have been allowed into China for the purpose. Talk a little bit about these exercises, Bob. There's an old army line about, train as you intend to fight. What do they tell us about how not just the Chinese, but the Russians as well, jointly perhaps, may intend to fight us with nuclear weapons?
Well, it's very clear that the military and political relationship between Moscow and Beijing has expanded very fast and very, very deep. And that includes not just conventional military exercises. And by the way, there's one going on, I believe, as we speak, but also across the board. And this really raises, questions about the futility of having a strategic stability dialogue with Russia, which was just kicked off last month in Geneva. I mean, how do you have strategic stability discussions with Russia, leaving China out? And China has no interest in nuclear arms control. They've made that very clear over and over and over again. This whole notion of strategic stability is one that troubles me, because even if it's isolated to Russia, Russia is not interested in strategic stability. Russia is interested in superiority. For Russia, stability comes from being superior to the United States. And if you include China,
particularly in the nuclear capability area, because that's really the place they can compete.
And not only compete, but in my view, they have succeeded in achieving superiority to date if you include all of their nuclear forces.
And the modernity of their nuclear forces and the vast variety of them as well. Some 22 systems, I believe, have been introduced in the new modernization program that they've, just about completed. But Bob, to this point, because I think, again, the arms controllers have largely run the table on all of this for so many years. The notion has been that the bilateral relationship between the United States and the Russians, the Soviets before them, had to be governed by these arms control agreements. You've been involved in many of them, the negotiation of them or efforts to ensure compliance with them, among other things. But in point of fact, that was always, in part at least, rationalized by the fact that the Chinese weren't real players. They had these, minimal deterrent forces, as you say. It seems as though they were absolutely wrong about the Russians having any interest in parity and stability and, reducing forces in ways that would minimize the danger to each of us on the one hand, and that the Chinese have been stealing a march on us all this while.
Right. Arms control has paid tremendous dividends for Russia and has allowed Russia, in my view, to achieve strategic superiority. And if you just look at New START from 2010, what happened under New START? We went down, they went up, Russia went up, and China was left to continue its nuclear expansion, which is now, again, described as breathtaking.
But Bob, also speak to this, because you're a serious student of these matters, as well as a practitioner of nuclear deterrent policy over the years. What does it mean that the Russians and Chinese have both overtaken us dramatically, I think, in terms of the modernity of our forces? What does it mean that ours are essentially forces that were deployed when you and I were working together in the Pentagon during the Reagan administration and haven't been improved very much since?
Well, I think if you go back to sort of the end of the Cold War and you look at what happened in the United States in the context of nuclear weapons was we lost our technical capability. Clearly, that's the case if you look at the laboratory. We lost our operational capability. Nuclear weapons were just considered, something that would never be used and that was just out there in case of some sort of, existential threat. And we lost our policy capability. What happened with the Russians and the Chinese? The Russians built up their capabilities to a point where they now exceed ours, if you consider, again, the overall arsenal of nuclear forces. And now we see,
including 10,000 tactical nuclear weapons, something like that, right?
Well, I think I've seen estimates from 4,000 to as much as 10,000. And as for the Chinese, well, they continued their modernization all along. And we haven't even talked about nuclear testing, which we haven't done, and which the Russians and the Chinese have. And in fact, the Chinese just recently expanded their nuclear test site. And that's all part of this incredible breakout of nuclear capability.
And again, Bob, the implications of all of this are what, as you see them?
Well, I think the implications of the Chinese expansion are if we don't take action now, and it's beyond modernizing our triad, our strategic forces. If we don't put together a credible, capable, comprehensive strategy for dealing with the threat by 2049, which is the year that President Xi has declared China will be a world power, and not only a world power, I believe he means the world power, we will lose. We will lose in the Asia Pacific. And I think with regard to Russia, and Russia, you know, Russia is an interesting case because it, without nuclear, one would have to consider it a declining power. But even there, I mean, I think we're the loser in Europe too. And if I'm President Putin and I'm looking at the United States right now and we're saying, well, we need to reduce reliance on nuclear weapons and we need to reduce the role and reduce the numbers of nuclear weapons, I couldn't be more appreciative if I'm Putin. And I would become very tempted to test NATO. And if he does that, we might very well lose Europe too.
This is, it seems, his clear purpose to reverse what he considered to be the greatest catastrophe of the 20th century, namely the fall of the Soviet Union, and to do it at our expense in a way that will both humiliate us and restore, Russian greatness. And I think it's folly to think that these seeming opportunities to advance such agendas, whether it's Chinese world domination or whether it's the Soviet era, you know, empire, in circumstances in which they seem no longer to be deterred, we ought to anticipate they will be pursuing these kinds of policies aggressively. Bob, let me ask you quickly before we have to let you go, one last question. The Chinese have tipped their mitt in a way about something that we had also, I think, long ignored about their programs. With the outbreak of the COVID-19, or I call it the Chinese Communist Party virus, we've had cause to address ourselves much more directly at long last to the biological weapons program of Communist China. And there are reports, including some attributed to a former defense minister of China, that the object of their biological weapons program has been to depopulate the United States, going back to Deng Xiaoping, who started the thing illegally. The thought being that they would like to colonize the place, and biological weapons, as they have demonstrated with COVID, can help accomplish that and leave the place essentially intact, which is a lot better than a radioactive mess, which is what would happen if they were to launch nuclear weapons against us, needless to say. What do we know about their BW program, Bob? And how seriously do you take this as at least a part of this Chinese plans for dismantling us and dominating the world?
Well, I have no doubt that China, like Russia, has and continues to aggressively pursue biological warfare capabilities. And here again, arms control plays a role, because there is an arms control convention, which we follow scrupulously, that outlaws biological weapons and research on offensive biological weapons as well. We bought into that. The Russians signed up. This was still in the days of the Soviet Union. And lo and behold, the Soviet Union goes away. And what do we find? Well, not only did the Russians not give up their biological program, they expanded it many fold. I mean, thousands of individuals, you know, working on the worst sorts of agents one could find. Now, we don't have that transparency into China, but
you'd have to be a fool not to believe that China is aggressively pursuing a whole series of biological agents that we couldn't contemplate in the case of Russia. We just couldn't. We didn't contemplate the use of SS-18, their large ICBM capabilities, having biological warheads on them to ensure that after the nuclear strike, anybody that was still alive would be killed by the biological agent. This is how they think. But the Chinese, I believe, think the same way. Okay, we have much transparency, but I think, if COVID-19 doesn't wake us up, nothing will.
Bob, we have to leave it at that. I just want to say thank you so much for both your time and your leadership on these issues over the years and your clarity, particularly about how arms control actually has worked in practice with totalitarian, closed, and dangerous regimes like those of, the former Soviet Union, Russia, now China. And, that clarity is so needed, Bob, because I don't need to tell you that despite this very checkered record, to be charitable, of the arms controllers on so many of these fronts, they still enjoy a dominance that I believe is contributing materially to our lack of preparedness in our nuclear deterrent posture, our infrastructure to support it, our policy approach, as you say, to assure that we have the kinds of deterrents that we need. Next up, we'll speak with Charles Sam Faddis about the enemy within, who they are, will surprise you right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and I'm very pleased to say, joined by one of our regulars here at Secure Freedom Radio, Charles Sam Faddis, a man of many parts, who has, among other things, served with great distinction our country as a uniformed officer in the United States Army, as a man without a uniform, a clandestine services officer in the Central Intelligence Agency, a deputy attorney general out in Washington State, a candidate for Congress. He's also a very accomplished author, including, among his nonfiction works, Beyond Repair, The Decline and Fall of the CIA, in which he served for some time, and it has informed a lot of what he does these days, among other things, as a driving force behind an absolutely stupendous online resource and magazine.com. Sam Faddis, good to have you with us, as always.
Great to be here, Frank. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Sam, and thank you especially for a piece to which I know you contributed substantially, both at AND and at the Accountability Initiative. And I encourage everybody to check out the resources at accountabilityinitiative.org. It's about a fellow, Joshua Geltzer, this most recent piece, who you've described as Biden's advisor on countering domestic violent extremism. Tell us what we should know about Joshua Geltzer, besides the position he holds and, what it entails. What is his background and why does it make so ominous the idea this fellow would be in such a position?
Well, of course, the Biden administration is filled with all sorts of folks who are really concerning, at a minimum, given their ideological backgrounds and their connections to China and so forth. Even in that company, Geltzer is maybe the single most terrifying guy that I have run across because, well, for a variety of reasons. First of all, he's very, very smart. He's an accomplished attorney. He's very, very precise. He's definitely a wordsmith. And he, in this role as the special assistant to the president for countering domestic violent extremism, is the guy who is the point man on this entire focus of the Biden administration on labeling their political opponents as terrorists, essentially, and then weaponizing big tech, intelligence, law enforcement to go after them. So I refer to him in shorthand as Biden's MAGA hunter. He is the architect and he is the guy driving the train, even though most people have never heard his name. His entire, part of the reason he's so terrifying is this. Most people, as a common sense matter, I mean, first of all, let's start with this. The entire domestic violent extremist fantasy, which is basically a white, supposedly this army of white supremacists that are getting ready to overthrow the government, is, of course, a lie. It's a fantasy. It's a political construct designed to justify acting against political opponents. But most people, when they hear the idea of a violent extremist, they assume we're talking about terrorists. They assume we're talking about people, as a matter of common sense, who either committed violent acts or are preparing in some concrete way to commit violent acts. And what Gelser has laid out very effectively, really, is this whole legal and semantic construct whereby if you are enabling that or encouraging that, and those are the key words, what exactly they mean, you are now also a violent extremist. And if you work this all the way through Gelser's language, if you are pushing or broadcasting or propagating what he calls misinformation, again, a key phrase because he gets to define it, you are in effect exactly the same as somebody who's blowing something up or preparing to blow something up. So when you add all of this together, since he's the guy who decides what's misinformation and he decides what are the acceptable facts, if you are in any way saying something that Joshua Gelser does not believe in, does not consider a fact, you can be labeled as a domestic violent extremist and at a minimum silenced. And presumably we can take steps further than that and start arresting you and taking you away.
And your thesis is that he actually has that purpose in mind as well as the capability in this role as a special advisor in the White House on domestic violent extremism to begin carting political prisoners off to the gulag?
Yeah, I mean, another thing we should note about Gelser is that Gelser started this, he started down this road years ago before Biden even stepped into the White House. When Donald Trump was still in the White House, Gelser was one of the point people who was spreading the idea that Trump was a tyrant. In fact, he essentially, well, he said that outright. Trump is a tyrant. He is acting unconstitutionally. And then specifically in the run-up to the election, he was one of the primary movers in pushing the idea that Trump intended to not leave the White House, that he was going to overthrow the government, that he was going to act and declare himself essentially, I guess, king, which, of course, was never true. And there was never any factual basis for any of that. But Gelser began already then to push this thesis because it's not just Trump, right? It was the entire MAGA movement is unconstitutional and intends to destroy the republic. And he is, I mean, what I just described in terms of his ideas I'm not extrapolating. This is, as we laid out in what we wrote at the Accountability Initiative, all you have to do is literally just read what he has written and listen to what he says. And he says these things expressly. So you can have free speech. This is one of the most critical elements. You can have free speech, but in Gelser's view, and he's expressly stated this way, only if it is based upon an agreed upon set of facts. But he doesn't really mean agreed upon. He means approved set of facts. So as long as you are saying what Gelser and the administration say you can say, you still have free speech. If not, you are spreading misinformation, you are encouraging domestic violent extremism, and expressly, in Gelser's words, you are the same as somebody who's committing a violent act. In fact, he says expressly, we can't any longer wait for plots to develop That's passé. That time has come and gone. We must be much more proactive and seek out and get rid of these people before they get anywhere close to that.
That's actually something he has said, Sam, reports to that effect?
Absolutely. He has said that exactly. The idea of waiting for a plot to develop is too late. We can't wait for that. We have to go out and get these people. And these people are not what you and I would think, like a guy who's building a bomb in his basement or trying to acquire the materials to do so. Spreading misinformation, again, he defines it, makes you a domestic violent extremist.
And Sam, a couple of thoughts on this. One is that, of course, this idea of violent extremism is something that we recall from the Obama administration, when basically the Muslim Brotherhood was trying to deflect attention from the Islamists that were then the necessary focus of our attention. They wanted it to be on, well, gun-toting veterans and white supremacists and others. And this has now become essentially official policy in this administration. But again, it does seem as though Josh Geltzer is projecting, you know, if anybody is engaged in unconstitutional conduct, it would seem to be him, or at least what he is preparing to do.
Well, yeah, I mean, from a psychological standpoint, yes. But I mean, Geltzer, this is why I consider him, why I said I consider him maybe the single most terrifying guy in the administration. Geltzer is no fool, far from it. Geltzer is obviously extremely smart, extremely well-read, and a very accomplished attorney. He knows precisely what he's doing because he's establishing the legal predicate, the foundation, to allow for all sorts of action. I mean, his immediate focus right now, amongst other things, is on getting big tech to cooperate even more fully with the government to completely silence anybody who's speaking out of line. I mean, anything that he says, he uses. Yeah, if you are spreading what he calls a conspiracy theory or disinformation or misinformation, that, in his words, is a gateway to violence, and you have no right to do that. So now, since he gets to decide what is a conspiracy theory, misinformation, or disinformation, he therefore has the right to muzzle you and shut you down and make it so it's impossible for you to speak.
Now, Sam Faddis, you are an attorney, among other things. Does this rise, this use of third parties, Facebook or Google or what have you, Twitter, to suppress speech, ostensibly because it is misinforming, on behalf of the United States government, to a violation of the First Amendment freedoms of our country?
Yeah, without question. Without question. And those challenges need to be made. I mean, there's no way that the government can simply sidestep this and say, well, that wasn't me. I hired this guy to break in your door and search your house in violation of the Fourth Amendment. I hired this guy to take away your computer and tell you that you can't speak.
Or simply commission them, urge them.
Yeah.
Incited them.
Exactly. That does. Yeah. That, from a legal standpoint, that doesn't work. That doesn't.
Well, this needs to be, this needs to be brought, it seems to me, to a head in the courts urgently, because it's obviously something that Josh Geltzer has in mind for all of us. Thank you, Sam Faddis, for this important report. Let me ask you for an update on another, Sam, at the Accountability Initiative. We've talked about the problem of Eric Swalwell on the House Intelligence Committee. I wanted to just get your read on the issue that I've talked about now with a number of our guests, including some members of Congress, about the dangers of a possible continuing relationship between Eric Swalwell and handlers at the Ministry of State Security of the Chinese Communist Party as a threat to the national security of the United States, and whether there's a powerful argument for removing him immediately from the House Intelligence Committee, where he is chairing, among other things, the Intelligence Modernization and Readiness Subcommittee of the House Intelligence Committee. Your thoughts?
Yeah, well, I think, amongst other things, one of the keys to understanding the danger posed by Swalwell is to stop obsessing about Fang Fang and some personal relationship with a female Chinese intelligence officer.
Swalwell was targeted by Chinese intelligence, by their Ministry of State Security, their CIA. They helped raise money for him. They helped get him in Congress. They put at least one individual working inside his office. And they were successful in getting him into Congress. We have actually no evidence right now to suggest that that relationship with Chinese intelligence ever terminated. One of their officers, Fang Fang, left the country. Okay. That's not all of their officers. They didn't shut down all their operations in the country. And a continuing relationship with Swalwell would not be, at this point, done publicly. It would be done clandestinely. So we don't actually know that he is not now still an agent of, or we do not know that he did not become an agent of Chinese intelligence and is, in fact, still one. So we may have a penetration sitting on the House Intelligence Committee.
Yeah, but to put a fine point on it, you ran agents undercover for the United States government. You know the tradecraft. You've practiced it. And it's not just unique to the Central Intelligence Agency and its operations. It's the tradecraft of espionage services. Talk about the likelihood that the Chinese Communist Party, having made the investment they did in this bright young man, or not so bright, but aspiring young man, to cut him loose after he was made for his relationship with Fang Fang.
Look, obviously, the entire purpose of this is to recruit a guy at the early stages so that when he then makes it into the Congress, he's your guy. And they have, if you follow that road, they have now succeeded brilliantly. He is sitting on the House Intelligence Committee. You would never give up that contact unless you were absolutely forced to. You have invested years of work in that. And how would you meet, you know, your contact with him now would be what we would call denied area tradecraft. He would have electronic communications, or he would be making dead drops, or he would be met out of country, or all of the above. We have no way of knowing whether or not that is still ongoing. Now, if there was a damage assessment done, which one would presume must have been done years ago, that allows Pelosi to say with confidence he doesn't work for the Chinese, then let's declassify that and let's see that. And let's bring that out in the light of day and assure us that we don't have a Chinese spy reporting to Beijing every 24 hours on what the House Intel Committee sees.
Amen. There's a letter to the Speaker of the House on that very topic that I hope will be published shortly, and I appreciate, Sam, your insights in all of this. I'd wanted to talk to you about Hunter Biden as a Chinese Communist Party ongoing asset as well, but that's for another day. Thank you for your time on this occasion, Sam, and for the chance to visit with you about some of the really important work that you're doing both at AND Magazine and, of course, at accountabilityinitiative.org. I encourage everyone to take a good, close look at the resources there. Thank you, Sam. God bless you, my friend. Come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will do so again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.